You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest today is Sarah Pointer, who competed on the most recent season of the History Channel show, Alone. The competitors on Alone are truly alone. They rely on their knowledge and skills, building their own shelter, hunting and fishing, and gathering plants and berries. While they eke out a living off the land, they are also carting around camera gear and setting up their own shots, narrating the journey to survive. It is often a starvation game of body and soul, as food is difficult to procure and there is no human contact. Sarah lives in Squintna and, along with her husband Chris, owns the Tal Vista Lodge, a popular destination for locals and out-of-state adventurers alike. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer.
Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and you are listening to KSKA Anchorage, Alaska Public Media FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life in form.
The next meeting for the Board of Directors of Alaska Public Media will be on Friday, March 21st, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. via teleconference from the Elmo Sackett Broadcast Center. Additional information is on our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. With me today is Sarah Pointer, who was on the most recent season of the History Channel's Alone reality show. She's also the owner, along with her husband, Chris, of the Tal Vista Lodge in Squintna. Sarah, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Lisa.
First off, which I told you before we started recording, I'm a huge fan of Alone, and I was so excited to see you on the show and to see how well you did and also what a great representative of Alaska you were. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
And I'm just really excited to be able to interview you today and ask you about that Alone experience, but also to talk about the lodge and what it's like to live in a lodge in Alaska and what you do on your day-to-day. But first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up, what you did when you were growing up, and then we'll end up with how you got to Alaska.
You bet. I was born and raised in Florida, the exact opposite of Alaska. But I knew early on that the heat and the humidity was not for me. So I grew up in a lovely city full of retirees, lots of grandmas and grandpas in the neighborhood, well-loved, happy childhood. But there was always, you know, a craving for more. And once I got older, hop, skip, jumped my way across the country, ended up in Sun Valley, Idaho, where I met my husband, Chris. From there, we started a successful masonry construction company that expanded over to Bend, Oregon, where we moved with our children. And when we started to see the economy turning in 2008, we decided that we didn't want to fight for our paycheck anymore. And I asked my husband what he wanted to do and where he wanted to do it. And he said, I just want to go fishing in Alaska. So 1 year to that day, we found ourselves at Tal Vista Lodge and have been here almost every day since.
So was that a lodge that was already running and then you bought it from the owners or...
That's a long, complicated, drama-filled story. Let's say that we were brought up as a co-op of owners, and it evolved into us being the sole owners.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then how has that panned out? Like, obviously, you've been here since, what, 2008, 2009, and you've been here for a long time doing that, so you must enjoy it.
Absolutely love it. Yeah, we're going on 17 years this upcoming March, and... If somebody would have told me 20 years ago that this is what my future would have been, I would have argued up and down that there's no way I could be happy doing it. But I knew almost instantly once I got here out into the wilderness that this is where I belonged. Mm-hmm. And while the business side of it has been challenging, the lifestyle has... It's pure bliss. I mean, we live in God's country, and it is exactly what I needed to find my happy place.
Oh, wow. And one of the things that always fascinates me is how people from not just the East Coast, but the Southeast Coast make this big decision to move west. What about, like, you could have gone to North Carolina, which is like known for, you know, a lot of outdoor life and cool stuff, but you chose to come all the way out west. And do you have a sense of what drew you out here? Was it just like this yearning to be in this new place and like, oh, Idaho sounds good?
For me, it was family that brought me to Idaho. And then to get me to Alaska, it was my husband coming up here several times without me, doing some fishing and hunting adventures, and would come back to Oregon and just tell me about how beautiful it is, how wild it is, how amazing all the people were. And so when he said Alaska is where he wanted to be, I barely blinked. I started packing.
So what is a day-to-day life like at the lodge? I mean, this lodge is run year-round?
We're a year-round lodge, but as you know, freeze-up and break-up are times that are we're out here alone. In the summer, we have a full-time fishing business. We have all five species of Pacific salmon. We were the first river to go catch and release on rainbow trout, great grayling population. So in the summer, we're fishing. And then in the winter, we're a snow machine destination. We are 60 to 90 miles off the road system, depending on which trail you take to come see us. So it's a great day ride. People come out, spend the night, spend a week, spend a month, and just explore the wilderness. And we also are part of the mushing community. We host one of the Iditarod qualifiers out here, the GB150, which is awesome. We absolutely love having the mushers come through.
Oh, that's great. And so your kids are they adults now?
They are. When we moved up here, our son was 8, our daughter was 13. It was a big culture shock for them.
I bet.
Yes, children are grown and gone now. I'm a grandma of 2. My daughter
Me
with
too.
The grandchildren. Oh, aren't they great?
Yeah.
My daughter and grandchildren live in Palmer, so I get to see them not as often as I like, but better than if they were out of state for sure. And my son lives out of state at the moment.
As I've mentioned to you before, I'm a huge fan of Alone. My brother turned me on to it. And I got turned on during the pandemic. And so I binged all the seasons that had happened. But then I'm also a huge Survivor fan. And the thing about Survivor and Alone, which I find so fascinating, is an Alone is about like, maybe I should start with Survivor. Survivor is less about the physical surviving part of it and more about the social surviving part of it. And Alone is more about the physical surviving part of it, but also like that you lack this social connection that's so important to human beings.
Yes.
And that's what I find so fascinating about watching those two shows, is that how different people handle those two different aspects of it. And so I think they're great shows to watch together, actually.
Survivor is a little too dramatic for me with the social interactions. It's too close to high school. It brings up bad memories. But you're absolutely right. With Alone, I live in isolation. My husband and I, we have to be social for our business. But we're hermits at heart. I'm not a touchy person. I'm not a walk up to a stranger and start a conversation. I'm an introvert through and through. But what I found during my time out on the land playing alone was, they'd occasionally come in for the medical check and a media check to change out the batteries and the SD cards. And one thing they would do is be a group of 5 to 8 of them coming into camp, every single one of them would either give me a hug or just reach out and touch my arm. Aww. And I found that I was craving that contact with just touch me, just let me know somebody else sees me in this world, because I feel so alone out here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's when I talk to people about the show, they're like, Alone. Oh yeah, but they have the camera crew there. And I'm like, no, they don't.
No, they don't.
So talk a little bit about that. Like, there's, for one thing, there's a huge amount of equipment that you have to haul in there, right? I mean, you have
there
to haul
is,
that
there...
in. And then if you move your camp, you got to move that equipment.
Yes. And it's about 60 pounds worth of gear, camera gear and batteries and all that stuff that goes with it. What I found the most challenging about the camera work was, anywhere you go, you have to have 1 to 3 cameras if you want to get this footage. And how How do you go hunting carrying all this gear? How are you quiet carrying all this gear? And then as the time went on, when I was out there getting weaker and weaker, it just got to be so heavy, even carrying, you know, a couple of GoPros. That's half a pound in my pocket that was just weighing me down the weaker I got.
Wow. And you also, you were like, you were hunting smaller game that's maybe more sensitive to sound, like timber, got that moose, but the moose are a little bit more maybe adapted to other things moving around, whereas birds and rabbits and stuff are more skittish.
Right. Well, I would have taken a moose if he would have walked by my yeah. camp. Let me tell you, I went looking for those moose, but Timber was calling them all his direction, that little jerk. but yes, the smaller game, you know, be as prey, they're more in tune to their surroundings. So yes, their hearing is better, their eyesight is better, and they're looking for predators. And there I am stomping through the woods, catching my camera on this, and my hair snagging in this, and I'm cussing up a storm. And yeah, stealthy and self-filming don't go well together at all.
Yeah. So how often do they come in to change out the batteries or to do a med check? And do those med checks, do they increase the farther in you get?
They do, yeah. You know, I was out there for 42 days, and I had people come into my camp about four or five times. So anywhere from 7 to 10 days. But when they would come in, the medical checks were longer, obviously, because they'd bring in a doctor and you'd have to go through all that and interviews. Most of the media checks, though, was like a whirlwind. They'd come in, they'd give me a hug, they'd grab the batteries, give me some new SD cards, do 15 seconds of an interview, and then they were out of there. So while I would see people, it would go through so fast that it was almost like, did I just dream that happened?
Yeah, I bet. Oh, that would be weird.
Yeah, it was.
And you were on the Mackenzie River, right?
Yes, we were on the Mackenzie River Delta.
Talk a little bit about landscape. I what struck me watching it is that the guys who were from Canada, and there was a woman from Canada.
Yes.
And you, who were more familiar with that kind of landscape, because it kind of blew the people who were from the lower 48, kind of blew their mind a little bit about what the landscape was like.
You're absolutely. When we first all got to orientation camp, you spend 7 to 10 days doing some pretty in-depth training about the local flora and fauna and terrain. It was real easy to pick out those from the lower 48 as opposed to the Canadians or an Alaskan like myself, because nothing looked familiar to them. We had one man, a Dusty, who had never left his town. He had never traveled on an airplane, had never left the country, had never seen snow. He was so far out of his element. He was like a kid in a candy shop. He was just in shock and awe. For me, you know, when I had heard that it was the Northern Boreal, I was excited because, you know, we live in the Southern Boreal. So how different could it be? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really, really different.
Oh, wow.
There were some things that were familiar, but the majority of it was like walking into a foreign land.
Mm-hmm.
So many plants I had never seen before. The weather was, I've never lived in a place that it blew so hard all the time with wind that if the wind ever stopped, it actually caught my attention. You know, I'd be looking around going, something just happened. What just happened? And the wind didn't blow.
It was quiet.
yes. I imagine that's what people like in the Palmer might feel like with the wind blowing all the time there.
Yeah. Yeah, they get some fierce wind.
They do.
What was it like being out there with, like, there's no ambient light from humans?
Not much different than where I live.
Okay.
You know, I'm far enough away that we can't see the city glow of anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the darkness, the lack of human lights off in the distance, that was familiar to me.
And when they drop you off, it's like, it seems fallish. So it seems like it's maybe late August where you
beginning
go
of
in?
September, beginning of September. And it was actually, it was a late launch. It was 2 weeks later than they had planned because if you remember last year, Canada was on fire, wildfires everywhere. And Inuvik had one really close to him and it was close to where we were set to play the game. So we got delayed by 2 weeks, which then pushed You know, we were out 2 weeks later than we were supposed to be. So all those berries that they were counting on us being able to access, the mushrooms, so much of the plants, they were dying by the time we got out there. So we lost 2 weeks of good foraging possibilities.
And foraging was a big part of your strategy, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Yeah. It's one of the passions I have with where I live is homeopathic and edible plants that grow around me. Mm-hmm. So I had that knowledge going into it, and I thank God I did. You know, what you saw me eat protein wise was all I got for protein. There wasn't any hidden meals. So those plants literally kept me alive and out there fighting for so long.
Mm-hmm. My plan was to go rewatch these shows, but I didn't. So I haven't watched them since the season played, because I'm like a dedicated person. The day it comes out, I watch it, you know.
I can beat you on that. I haven't watched any of the shows I've been on yet.
I was wondering about that. That was one of the things. Have you watched it at all? Because I know I don't listen to my shows. Because
right?
It's almost like painful in a way to listen and see things and everything. So you felt the same way though, huh?
Yeah, well, my intention was to watch it. My husband and I wanted to watch it when we were alone. We didn't want any outside people. It was a highly emotional thing for both of us, for me to go on this journey and him to wane out here during freeze-up all by himself without me. So we decided we were going to watch the show together when there's no one else here. But it aired when we had clients. So we were, okay, we'll do it during freeze-up. And now that we're in freeze-up, Chris unfortunately had to go to town to work. So we haven't had the chance. And to be honest with you, Lisa, I'm not too disappointed about it. I know with just the few commercials and season trailers they put out, it was so awkward to see myself.
Awkward. Yeah, I can imagine. I know exactly how you feel. So what originally made you apply to a loan?
I was home alone one freeze up. Chris was in town working again, and this new show had popped on, and I had nothing else to do and figured I'd watch it, never being a real big survival show enthusiast in the first place. And within moments of watching it, I called my husband up and said, I have got to do this. This is my calling. And he, of course, laughed because, you know, yes, I live in the wilderness. Yes, I'm an outdoor enthusiast, but I haven't always been this way. This is something that came with my move to Alaska. And so he, knowing me best, knew it wasn't quite within my normal character. But the desire just wouldn't go away. So a couple months later, I sent in an application, or I sent an email to him for the application process. And it took a few years for me to get selected.
Like a few years.
Yes. Years. I applied originally in 2019.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I didn't get accepted until 2023. And that's another long story in itself, but it was meant to be that way, because my life on the personal front took a big dive. My husband had some serious health issues. And if I had been gone during that time, I wouldn't have been here to help him heal from it. And so it played out the way it was supposed to be. And last year I got the call that said, we'd love for you to join us. And the rest is history.
Well, I would think this show, the very first season it started, which wasn't, what was it, in the teens, had the very first season didn't have any women on it.
Yeah.
I was kind of shocked because I'm like, there's women out here who do this stuff, you know?
There are. And there's a lot of them. But if you look at the percentage of how many women are in primitive outdoor survival, it's so minuscule compared to how many men are.
Yeah.
I know that the production of Alone would love more women. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, there you have it. Women need to go out and apply for this.
Exactly. They want you, women.
And I know there's lots of Alaskan women who could step up and heed the call.
Absolutely. I know a dozen of them that could go out there and kick butt.
And then this season, I was kind of surprised because there were only two women on this season, right?
Yes. Myself and Michaela. Michaela is an amazing young woman.
Oh, she was. I really liked her a lot. I really felt a connection to her as well. So I was sad to see her go.
Me too. I call her my Cree warrior princess because she is the perfect combination of tough and nurturing. She's just a beautiful woman, balanced in every way.
You made it's in the trailers, you made some comment about, I remember this because you were braiding your hair and you made some comment about the emotions, how the emotions of being out there by yourself were really hitting hard.
Yes. Talking with my fellow castmates and then some previous season cast, that's one of the things that people don't realize when they're watching the show is they see the physical aspect and they watch us physically degrade. But unless we vocalize it, they don't understand the mental and emotional breakdown we have to take away every comfort and piece of security you've ever had and then leave you alone with nothing but your own brain. Mm-hmm. The brain's a pretty scary place and emotions run high and everything mentally seems that much tougher, especially as you're, slowly starving out there. When you cut your calories down to 250 calories a day, that's what they estimated I ate out there was 250 calories a day. You start to lose your cognitive ability. You can't think clearly. And then your emotional side starts beating you up for it.
Yeah, that's one thing that I don't think a lot of people know is that the only fuel that your brain uses is carbohydrates. Right. So if you're going, especially if you're going heavy into just trying to survive out there on protein, your brain is getting no fuel at all.
Right.
And that's what is just really, really tough. So,
I would find myself so frustrated with myself. I remember one thing I was doing, I was trying to build a door and I had to tie some knots and I'm just like, I know how to do this, but I don't know how to do this. I know this knot, but I can't make my fingers remember how to move. And it was so hard knowing that I had the knowledge tucked away, but my brain was so weak it couldn't find the filing cabinet it was stored in.
Yeah, well, that's a great analogy. before you went, did you purposely gain weight?
No, I purposely stopped losing weight, actually. When I had moved to Alaska, I was a very heavy gal, and I carried that weight for, a good 12, 13 years, even out here with this active lifestyle. But then I made a little switch mentally, and I was finally able to start dropping some weight, and I had dropped 60 pounds. I got the call. We want you. And it's like, I'm not gaining weight for this show. I just lost 60 pounds. But what I did do is I stopped trying to lose weight. I went on what I call the marshmallow diet. I'd be eating campfire marshmallows every single day. I'd be drinking protein shakes. I was just trying to maintain my weight. And the reason I did that is I know a lot of competitors, they do. They gain a lot of weight. These guys that I competed with, they'd walk around orientation camp calling themselves patting their food babies.
Oh, yeah.
It's just gorge. I mean, they're eating 10,000 calories a day trying to gain weight.
Wow.
Meanwhile, myself, I was, maintaining that 1500 to 2000 calories because I didn't want to go in to the show with a different body. And if I had gained weight, I'd be all, moving awkwardly, more prone to accidents. My body would be demanding more calories because that's what I trained it to want.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was really important to not change my eating habits or what my body needed for calories before I went in. I wanted to be as healthy and comfortable with myself physically as I could be. And so that was my method of madness.
I do think there is this kind of balance that needs to take place. And because just like you said, if you're used to eating 10,000 calories and then you go out there and all of a sudden there's nothing in your stomach, you're going to have like those painful hunger withdrawals too.
Right. Yes.
Your stomach is distended and yeah.
Yes. I remember laughing at my castmates as they were just, like I said, literally just stuffing in piles of food every meal and mocking me because I'd have a piece of bacon or something for breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, about a week out there playing the game, just feeling such pity and sadness for these people who had become my friends, knowing that they must just be starving out there. Knowing that I never felt hunger the entire 6 weeks I was out there, my body never sent hunger pains. Now the entire time I was starving, but with my broths and the stuff, there was enough in my belly that I never felt hungry.
Right. Oh, yeah. And those guys, some of those guys were suffering real hunger pains. Like their stomachs really were hurting them, not just from a parasite, although that happens too. But yeah.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure they were.
Yeah. Yeah. They, yeah, that's right. You haven't really seen it. So
no, I haven't.
I can tell you they were suffering.
Oh, poor guys.
Do you think, I mean, I look at like, the three guys that were left in the end. So spoiler if you haven't seen the season.
No, I know who it was. That was yes, Timber, okay. Dove, and William. Yes.
Timber came in pretty thin. I mean, he did not look like he was. And I remember last year when there were, I forgot his name, that guy who was from Huslia, and he came in very thin too, and he had said, I just can't gain weight. You know, I'm just not a person who can gain weight. And I think that's what kind of really ended his journey soon, because he was obviously grown up hunting and fishing and building shelters. I mean, he had all the skills, but I think he just wasn't able to maintain any weight. He was so thin. Dub and William came in with a little bit more weight on them, especially William. And but do you think physiologically, women's bodies are just better adapted to this long-term starvation? I mean, if you want to call it starvation, because we do tend to hold more of our weight as fat. That's essentially energy that's stored.
I do. I do think women's bodies are built for it because of our extra fat content, and especially where we store that fat. You know, the abdominal region is the region that your body starts eating first. And so because we women tend to carry a little bit more in this area, I think it does help the woman's build going into it.
It just does seem that through the years I've watched the show that women survive that piece of it a little bit better. You
well,
know?
I think women are just tougher personally.
Well, I was going to say that too, but
I'll say it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I want to, and I'll put a link to this on the website, but I want to talk about what you're allowed to bring and what they give you before you go out there. So let's start with what essentials does the show allow you to take? Not your 10 items, but that they give to everybody.
Well, they don't give anything except camera gear and safety equipment to everybody, but they do give us a packing list for our clothing items. We're all allowed to bring X amount of pants, shirts, sweaters, very specific items. And everything that we choose to bring has to go through an approval process. First a pre-approval that says yes, then they'll look at it in more detail via an online link and give you another approval. Then you get to camp, they touch, they feel it and go, yes. And then even then, there's still a fourth inspection for them to go, okay, for sure you could take this item of clothing with you.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people come out with items of clothing that they also know that they can change into something else if they have to, right?
Yes, yes. They encourage you to bring extras in case anything is denied.
Yeah. And are they also looking to make sure that you're not trying to smuggle food in and stuff like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We not only do they inspect our gear, we had physical pat downs before we boarded that helicopter. I had hands go through my entire body to make sure I didn't have anything stuffed in my bra or down in my boot.
Wow.
Yes, I got frisked before I played the game.
Well, I know in the first year or two of Survivor, people did. Well, there's rumors that people did get food smuggled in. So,
Well, with Alone, the same things happen. People get really creative. There were, for example, arrow shafts. We couldn't have our knocks and our arrows when we got to camp because somebody had tried to bring sugar and salt in their arrow shafts.
Whoa!
There was a gal who took all of her buttons off of her sweaters and made sugar buttons and sewed them back on. People are always looking for an advantage. And so because of that type of behavior, now those beyond them are now getting frisked out and their gear's getting inspected deeper. And
So if they found you with some contraband, would they just take the contraband and you still go out there, or would they be like, oh, you can't be on the show?
If you were blatantly cheating, you would not be on the show. They not only are the 10 contestants at orientation camp, but they bring up two alternates. So at any point you could be pulled out and there's a replacement there to take your spot, very enthusiastically ready to take your spot.
Yeah. So there's a motivation not to cheat, obviously.
Exactly. And one of the best motivations, they explained it before we even launched, was if we catch you cheating, we're not going to tell the public what you did. You have to tell the public you cheated.
Wow.
And that right there was enough of an incentive for most people, you know, me especially. I don't want to confess that I just totally tried to cheat. Who wants to do that? So it kept me in line.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear more from Sarah Pointer about her experience as a cast member on the History Channel show Alone.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Hi, this is Jess Jang, an editor for Planet Money, and you're listening to KSKA Anchorage, Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
The 2014 election of Indian Prime Minister Modi marked a rise in Hindu nationalism.
So for them, to be Hindu is really to be authentically Indian. And what that raises, of course, is what does that mean for non-Hindus, for minorities in India?
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason.
This Friday at 8:30 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, or alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My conversation with Sarah Pointer, a cast member on the History Channel show Alone, continues.
Okay, so tell us about your 10 items, because it is everybody, like somebody has brought a block of salt before as one of their 10 items because it helped them with food, eating food and getting electrolytes and stuff. So tell us. Do you remember all your 10 items, or is it like in your head?
I don't know if I could name them off easily, but I have a general idea of what I took. Yes. With my 10 items, I could tell you that there is not a single one I could think that I would be willing to trade out for a different item. But if they would have allowed me 11 items, I would have been in heaven.
Yeah. And what would your 11th item had been?
I think my 11th item would have actually have been a food item. You know, I had looked at the list before I went in, you know, what you were allowed if you wanted to choose a food item, and the caloric value didn't make sense to me that I would, you know, leave behind a hatchet to take a bag of beans, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But after going through that, knowing that little bag of beans would have been just a little bit of protein, and it would have been a lot of mental and emotional health as a reliable food source, mm-hmm. that I think that that's what I would probably add on was a food item.
Mm-hmm. So I had
as
no idea
for
you
tools,
could...
I had everything I needed for tools. I just couldn't make it happen when it came to the hunting and the fishing and the trapping. I just, even though I had everything I needed, it just, I couldn't make it play out.
So do you think that's because it is just, it's a time of year where animals are kind of hunkering down, or, I mean, I don't hunt and fish, so I really don't know, you know, the behavior of animals and fish, but it seems like everybody has a difficult time procuring protein there.
I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that not much hunting is done in a primitive way. Yes, there's archery hunters out there, but they still have some of the modern technology tools to go along with them. A gun goes a long way, let me tell you. I would have rather have taken a bird with a gun any day over an arrow, get some distance to harvest. I think people struggle so much with the show procuring food because of camera gear mostly. You know, I had mentioned that earlier. It's so hard to go out and seek a protein source when you've got 20 pounds worth of gear and you're trying to film it and you're trying to be quiet. And I really think the self-filming is one of the reasons that people have so much difficulty getting protein.
Oh, interesting.
As for fishing, My biggest problem with fishing, I didn't find out till afterwards, but my specific spot on the river system was up a slough that froze weeks earlier than anybody else's. I was cut off of fishing, 2-3 weeks before everybody else who was playing was. So that complicated things.
And when they look for different sites for the show, they go out and they map out, like, you know, what, 3 or 4 acres that everybody's on, and then they
figure out miles. Not acres,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. yeah, I guess not acres. Yeah. But they also look for the food sources in that area, right? And they try to balance that for people.
They do. They go out first. They do several visits out to the land that they're going to divide these parcels on. They go out in the winter so they could look for animal tracks to see what's moving around on them. And then they go out early summer to see what the flora is, what plants are growing there. And so, yes, they try to balance it. They can't guarantee every parcel is going to be the same because they're out in nature. But say one parcel is high on berry growth and not so high on the mushrooms. But then the next parcel has a lot of mushrooms and not so many berries. And so they try to balance it in a way that it's as fair as nature could be.
Tell what protein starvation is. I never had heard about this before. Protein starvation. I had to look it up and go, oh, because Timber talked about that, I think, because he got this big moose right off the bat.
Right.
And
right.
So then you're kind of maybe thinking, I've got a lot of food. But in a lot of ways, you don't have a lot of food because you just have a lot of lean protein.
Exactly. You may have a full belly, but you're not getting your nutritional needs met. And so many of the times out there, most people who've played alone, protein is their biggest source of food. That's what they eat the most of. And so when you get back to your refeeding camp, you have to go through a strict diet as they teach your body how to handle carbs again, because you go full ketosis out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so to then go back to camp and eat a big cheeseburger and a side of bread and, you know, to stuff yourself with carbs, it could actually cause organ failure. So
I was wondering about that, like how they bring you back in, especially if you've been out there like you were for like a really long time.
Yeah. There's a dietitian that they bring in, and before you even play the game, you have a one-on-one with a dietitian who finds out what your eating style is before you play the game. And she was in charge of my menu plan. She worked with the cook at the lodge almost daily. They would talk to see how I did with the meals the day before. And it's a slow introduction back to food, too fast, and you could cause some serious harm. Mm-hmm. But medically, the team of Alone was amazing. They honestly cared about my mental health, my physical health. There was a doctors and paramedics and safety crews that worked very closely with me to make sure that I was healing properly after the trauma I had just put it through.
I mean, I imagine it's not just like your stomach and the nutrients going out to your body, but it's also your digestive tract that takes a big hit.
And oh, yes.
Yeah. Like somebody in the show, I think it was this year. I also watch Australia Alone. So, but I think, it's like every couple shows there's somebody who's having to be, who taps out because honestly, they can't poop. Like they're all backed up. Everything's backed up. It's not moving because you're not putting anything in your belly to move things through.
Yes. You, the number one medical reason that contestants tap out of Alone is constipation.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. How disheartening would that be
That would be.
Yeah. And part of the reason that happens is because they're just eating protein. They're not having any fiber go through their bodies. Me and my foraging being my main source of meals, I had enough fiber and soluble fiber that I didn't face those issues until I got back to camp and they fed me real food. And then my digestive system just, it stalled out for a week and a half. It didn't know what to do with the sudden influx of calories and solids. So digestion, it's the biggest organ that is affected by what we're doing out there.
The same thing happens on Survivor. There are people who have to leave the game because they can't go to the bathroom. So
yeah.
that, That's about the worst.
Yes.
We haven't talked about your shelter. So a couple of your items you took that were really important for the shelter, you took, and it seems like everybody takes these now, those big, huge collapsible saw blades, which are just
saws. Yeah.
Yeah. They're just so impressive, you know, and then a hatchet, of course, is important. Mm-hmm. And then there's other things like paracord that has multiple uses. You know, you can use it for a fishing net, or you can use it on your shelter. So talk about what you decided to do about your shelter.
Yeah, for me, I went with the WikiUp shelter because for me as a woman, I knew going out there, I was not going to have, one, the strength to build a log cabin, or two, the desire to burn the amount of calories necessary to build a log cabin or some other big structure. I picked the WikiUp because one, it was one I could build by myself, and two, because it was a smaller shelter, and the smaller your shelter, the less of a space you have to have to heat up. Mm-hmm. So I went with that shelter, and it worked beautifully for me. I had some design flaws that I don't know if it made the air or not, that I was constantly having to fix things here and there. But when it rained, I stayed dry. When it snowed, I stayed dry. When the wind blew, if I had my door closed, I stayed warm. This shelter served me well.
And you had like a stove type or a fire pit or something inside the shelter.
I did have a fire pit, and I had originally planned on starting this fire and being able to bank the coals so I wouldn't have to keep relighting the fire with my fire stick. But it didn't take me long to find out as I was digging my fire pit that the water level of the lake and the river nearby was only, 12 inches below where, surface level. And so when I dug my fire pit, water would leach through, and by morning my ashes would be soaking wet. So I had to light a fire every single day.
Oh, and that's, you had a what's called a ferro rod.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Ferro rod.
And
you
chose a one that had a octagon or something that had edges around it instead of a straight one. And what was your reasoning behind that?
Well, a typical ferro rod is brown. And so with the hexagon shape, it gave more surface area with my striker. Mm-hmm. And it noticeable difference in how quickly and hotly a spark would fly. That extra surface from that particular shape was really beneficial in getting a fire started earlier.
Because you only have so many strikes on those, right? Is that right?
And that's the funny thing is when my ferro rod arrived, the packaging said that I had 100,000 strikes with a particular size rod. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
A few days before I had to tap out, I was looking at my ferro rod and had to do a double take because when you're initially doing the first strike, there's more pressure than when you're down at the bottom of the rod. And so I was eating my ferro rod away where, the rod was about this thick, but where I was striking was only about that thick. And I could see the potential of it eventually breaking and me having two little short ferro rods.
Oh, yeah, that would be hard.
That would be hard, yeah. Just holding on to that cold metal ferro rod when it was, 0 degrees outside and you couldn't wear gloves because I couldn't get the strike to work if I had gloves on. Oh, my fingers would just burn with pain from the cold. Just please God, get this fire started. I'm going to have frostbite from the ferro rod.
Oh, my gosh. And a ferro rod is different than like flint, right? Because you have to get the magnesium off of flint and then strike that magnesium. But a ferro rod, you can just, it just sends a hot, hot spark out.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I remember one of the Alones years back where the guy lost his ferro rod on the third day.
It's a big fear of everybody's. And I initially had the plan of tying it on a piece of paracord and wearing it as a necklace. But then I realized, this rod is this big and it weighs, a couple ounces and I don't need an anchor around my neck. And so I'd always have it in a specific place. Uh-huh. But in the beginning of the game, before, before I knew the bears had gone to bed, I wouldn't ever do my fire or my cooking near my camp or at camp. I would do it a couple hundred yards away because I didn't want the predators smelling the food. And so I'd have to carry it over there and I'd have to not lose it. And I'd have to bring it back. And it was so much anxiety of keeping track of where did that ferro rod go. Oh my God, did I lose the ferro rod? Oh, never mind, it's in my pocket. So much fear, because without, you know, especially being how I had to, I couldn't bank my coals and keep a fire going. I had to be able to make a fire, or I knew I couldn't make it. And not for cooking, and not necessarily for heat, but to boil my own water. My water source was a lake that beavers were swimming in. I obviously had to boil my water. So if I were to have lost that ferro rod, my game would have been over instantly.
Mm. Hey, let's talk about that beaver.
Okay.
you saw this beaver and you're like, oh, this would be a great source of food. He's got fat, he's got protein, he's got everything. He's got a nice little pelt I could use, probably.
Oh, right? Yes.
So what happened there?
Oh, it was a war with the beaver the entire time I was there. I know a scene made it where I had flung an arrow out into the lake and I missed him. I was so mad at myself, because I knew you don't shoot into a body of water. If I lose my arrow, that arrow is gone. Don't bring me more. I have exactly this many arrows. I have to be careful with them. But that moment of desperation of look at all those calories and that fat and that protein swimming around, I lost my mind. I flung an arrow into the lake, and I had to pay the price not only by going into the cold water, but now I have to live with the fact that the entire world has seen me in my sports bra going into the water after doing something so stupid. So I have to live with that. But that beaver, you know, I stalked that beaver. I tried to trap that beaver. And that beaver's still living happily ever after without me, let me tell you.
That's what's so amazing is, like, well, there's two kind of lessons there. Is, again, how hard it is to get game, you know, and you seemed like you were in a pretty secure space at that point. You were kind of settled right there, so you weren't having to drag your camera equipment around, but it's still hard to get the game, you know? And then the other thing, because you're depleted, your brain is depleted, that you start to make these, like you said, desperate moves to get food.
Yes, the desperate moves, such as flinging the arrow, the desperate move of sitting there trying to spot and stalk, knowing he'd most likely come up this beaver slide tonight, but the temperature had dropped so much and the wind was howling so bad. But I wanted that food so bad that I sat out there exposed to the elements to the point that I stopped shivering. And you know, it finally kicked in that I'm going to die for this damn beaver, and had to go back to camp and climb in. And and the longer I was out there, and the less I was able to feed my body and my brain, suddenly I couldn't tie up the self-locking snares. So I snared that beaver several times, but because I couldn't make my brain work because I was starving out there, I couldn't keep the beaver. I just, like I said, the beaver still lives happily ever after.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things, like, you hear a lot of people say when they come on the show is, like, you watch the show and you think, oh, I could go do all that stuff. But when you get out there, it's just a whole different game. It's just, it's just way harder than you could have ever imagined.
Yes. And we call them couch judges, because so many people sit at home and judge us for what we did out there. But no, until you live it, until you put your body and your brain and your soul through that type of desperate isolation, no, you can't judge anything any of us have done out there.
It seemed like there were a lot of predators out there this year too, like a lot of wolves. Did you hear wolves and bears around camp? And
yeah, so with the bears, I know my fellow castmates had a lot of problems with bears. I never saw a sign of bear when I had gotten there. There were some bear prints that went down the beach along the river. Never had another sign of them anywhere my entire stay, so bears were not a worry to me at all. One of my favorite days out there, it was actually a night, was the night the wolves howled all night long. From the moment I went to bed to the moment I woke up, they were walking their territory line howling all night, and their territory went entirely around my parcel. It was magical listening to them.
But that's also probably something that you're used to in lodge life, is seeing these predators out there and around and
When in the at orientation camp, they do a pretty in-depth personal interview as you're there on the land getting ready to launch, and they really, you know, talk about the predators, and they're, Sarah, aren't you scared about the bears and about the wolves? And it's, no, that's not my fear out here. You know, if I'm going to be scared of an animal, I have a bigger fear of getting stomped on by a moose.
Exactly.
But my biggest fear out here has nothing to do with the wildlife. My biggest fear is the elements, you know, because of where I live. I understand the danger of cold and wet and wind and hypothermia. And so, no, my biggest fear going into the game had nothing to do with the apex predators. It had everything to do with environment and weather.
Okay, so let's talk about your exit from the show. And I have to tell you, I'm seeing the four of you left there, and I'm like, wow, I think Sarah's going to win this, because I felt like you had dealt with the food piece of it so well, that you were able to forage, and you know, you weren't acting like you were super hungry and everything, and you seemed pretty emotionally okay, you know, and everybody kind of gets to be a mess there towards the end. The only person who didn't was William. He never seemed like it bothered him at all. So
William's amazing.
Yeah, he was a pretty fun guy. He was definitely a lot of fun. And he, you know, really, to watch the show and see some of the things he did, like he eventually made because he was getting his game stolen all the time. Mm-hmm. So he eventually, when it got cold enough, he made basically an ice chest out of ice. He just poured water and kept him encased in ice.
Oh, brilliant.
And this little Martin that had been bugging him couldn't get to it. It was hilarious.
Brilliant.
Yes, it was really, I've never seen anybody do that. So that was pretty cool. So you started to have some really severe pain, and you were pretty sure it was coming from your kidney. And, you know, I thought immediately that it was maybe a kidney stone, but they never told us what it was. And I hope you're willing to share that, because I was really bummed, because I'm like, she would have been here a lot longer if it hadn't been for something that just happens to your body and you have no control over.
It was pretty heartbreaking. Yeah. I had, I started to notice when I was out hiking that I started to have this pain in my lower back on my left side. And I thought, okay, it's just my quiver bouncing against an area that used to have more padding and now it doesn't. And then I noticed shortly thereafter that, you know, just standing there, I was getting this pain that I found myself hunching over to relieve it. And then one night, I went to bed and it felt like somebody had stuck an ice pick into my kidney. Oh. And I had no sleep that night. Just, you know, begging God to take the pain away. Don't let this be the reason I'd have to tap out. Yeah. But I had made a promise to Chris before I went. He made me make this promise because he knew I am the type of person that I would have died out there rather than tap out. I'm that type of person. And so before I went on the game, Chris made me promise that I would tap out one day before I broke physically or mentally. So it was really important to keep that promise. And I, knowing that it could potentially be an organ, I couldn't take the risk. And so I had to place that call, and they came and got me. And I found out shortly after I got to camp that, my organs were fine. What had happened is my body had cannibalized itself so much that it just, my core was gone. My core muscles were gone, that it hurt just to support my own frame, own skeletal frame. So thankfully, nothing permanent, no damage was done to my organs. It was just my pride that, you know, I had to tap out.
It was the right decision to make.
And it didn't take me long to realize it was the right decision because of how quickly my body recovered from what I put it through. You know, on the day I tapped out, I haven't seen what I look like on TV, but I took a selfie of myself and, you know, my face is gray and I looked like I had aged 20 years out there and I was all gaunt and I just looked ill. 24 hours later, after being fed and hydrated and warmed up, I look like I look today. My cheeks plumped up, the color came back, my hair quit falling out. So it was definitely the right decision to make. If I would have gone further, it was very possible I could have caused damage that I couldn't heal from. And as much as I wanted to win, it was not worth hurting myself forever. Right. Over.
Thank you, Chris.
Right? Thank you, Chris. Yes. I did tell him there. That if I ever get the honor of going back, I'm not making that promise to him, damn it.
I'm so excited to hear that you are open to going back at some point.
Oh, yeah. So they ask that after you get back to refeeding camp and you've had some time to heal and get back in touch with your loved ones, they do this really intensive interview to go through everything that you went through during your time out there. And one thing they ask every single contestant is, would you be willing to go back? And you think of these people you've seen who've just been through hell. 95% of them say in a heartbeat.
Yep.
It's just, there's something about being out there. It was the most amazing experience of my life. And if I ever got that chance, I would jump at it again.
Oh, good. I hope you do. And I think you probably have a little bit better chance also being a woman, that they want to get women on the show. So you're in a little smaller cohort of people they need to choose for. And on the return shows, women have won those shows, you know? So.
Yeah. Well, one thing I could tell you is I know in talking with past contestants and my own fellow castmates that the online hate that is directed towards people that have played that show is intense. Wow. My fellow castmates got messages from strangers saying, you are a stupid idiot and you should just die. I mean, that's the type of hate that is sent our way. So I was terrified to do this because of that. I don't invite drama into my life intentionally. But what I found out is, so I go on the show and then somebody who's been opposed to social media, I decide I'm going to start an Instagram account in case somebody out there saw my story out there and just wants to reach out. Because I went through a lot of emotional stuff out there. So I started Instagram and I have gotten 100+ letters from women around the world who said, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for showing that a woman could be strong and also show her vulnerabilities.
Yep, exactly.
And that's what I got out of the show. I didn't get a single hate mail from anybody.
Wow.
I got nothing but love and appreciation and gratitude for being authentic.
Well, Sarah, I would love to see you back on the show. I hope you do get back on like an All Stars or something. I would love to see
that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining me today. If you make it back, then we're going to interview you again. And this has been a really fun conversation. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been great talking with you.
This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Sarah Poynter. You can find out more about Sarah and her alone experience on the Outdoor Explorer page on alaskapublic.org. The show is produced by Tobin Shelby with help from Ammon Swenson. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation, operating the Fleets, Inn Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sand Point, K.
K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting is generously supported by the City of Sandpoint. Sandpoint is a first-class city in the Aleutians East Borough, located on Humboldt Harbor on the northwestern Popoff Island. Anchorage is 575 nautical miles to the northeast. The Sandpoint City Council meets the second